I'm going to bring up now Carl Hangebauer. Dr. Hangebauer was a 1984 graduate of Bastyr University and one of the founders of the California Association of Naturopathic Doctors. He holds license number 2 in California, so he's definitely been instrumental in California licensure. And your current president of the AANP, Dr. Hangebauer.
Thanks. Welcome to Portland, everybody, and welcome to our 25th convention. I'm here with the honor of introducing our next speaker, Dr. Jared Zeff, who we all know and love, and one who embodies the roots of our profession, our philosophy of care. Dr. Jared Zeff has been a teacher for many in this room, as well as a clinician, scholar, and author. In 1986, he co-authored The Principles of Naturopathic Medicine and is nationally regarded for his practice of classic naturopathic medicine. As senior editor of the Foundations of Naturopathic Medicine Project, Dr. Zeff is working to codify our medicine for generations to come. Today, Dr. Zeff will share how his life's work changes the lives of his patients and improves the health of the world. He will address challenging questions and concepts for all of us to consider, including how our medicine has developed over time and the likely future for naturopathic traditions in this age of integrative healthcare and expanding prescription privileges. This discussion promises to be controversial and politically incorrect. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jared Zeff.
Thank you. First, I want to thank Almighty God and my Lord Jesus Christ for the privilege of standing before you today, and especially to thank Karen Howard and her staff for the work they have done to foster and promote our little profession in the national arena and in organizing this amazing conference. I want to congratulate Carl for his excellent leadership this past year. I was asked to speak about the roots of naturopathic medicine. I asked more specifically, well, what do you want me to talk about? I was told, you know, the roots of the medicine. In other words, I could talk about whatever I wanted to talk about. Okay, what are roots? They're the anchor. They're the source of nourishment. They go deep. They hold you down in against the fierce winds and the drenching storms, against the floods. If your roots are deep, you need not fear when the heat comes, for your leaves will always be green. In the year of the drought, you will never fail to bear fruit. Deep roots. Do we have such roots? What are our roots? Immediately, the roots of this association begin with the vision of a doctor who is here today. I want to thank Jim Sensenig, who had the vision and leadership to create this organization and provide its original direction, along with Kathy Rogers, Alan Gamble, Terry Davis, Bill Tribe, John Weeks, Jeff Klass, Mike Cronin, Tim Burtzel, Joe Pizzorno, and others, some of whom you do not see here. They say this is our 25th anniversary. Where were we just 25 years ago? We had 6 states under licensure and 4 Canadian provinces. We've made great progress since I joined this profession in 1975 as a student at National College of Naturopathic Medicine, then our only school. In 1980, Bill Tribe, a former student at NCNM who had become an administrator, did a survey of the profession in the U.S. and Canada. We were trying to determine how many of us were there. It was difficult to determine. There was no central data bank, no national association. The NANP, National Association of Naturopathic Physicians, had gone bankrupt 2 years before. The original ANA, American Naturopathic Association, that had been created by Benedict Lust, was not functioning. Most of the states that had licensed naturopathic physicians up through the 50s and 60s no longer licensed us. In the absence of a central data bank, he had to research, before the days of the personal computer and the World Wide Web. He had to determine which states had ever licensed us and try to find records from those states that no longer had licensing boards. He had to contact older docs and ask what they knew. He had to find and go through old records. He had to make some assumptions and judgments. Is a licensed mechanotherapist in Ohio the same as a naturopathic physician? Or a naturopath in Illinois? Were these limited forms of naturopathic medicine or something else entirely? How about a sanopractor in Washington? How did one define a naturopathic physician? There were several docs practicing in Idaho. Idaho did not license naturopaths. Did these guys count? Did their educations make a difference? How did we define and number a practicing naturopathic physician? There were practitioners in states with defunct boards like California who still had licenses. They were left over from previous times, and as long as they paid their fee to the state every year, they maintained their license, like Dr. Ettinghausen, the naturopathic obstetrician. There were retired and semi-retired docs. Quebec had vastly different standards for licensure than the rest of Canada and the U.S. Did they count? They had no educational standard. These were some of the questions that made a head count rather difficult. And this was before the creation of the ANMA and the rise of the diploma mills, the major of which, Clayton College, has just closed, praise God. By 1950, there were 18 jurisdictions in the U.S. that licensed naturopaths, and at least five in Canada. 30 years later, there were fewer than half that. The best count Bill could come up with was there were somewhere between 175 and 225 licensed naturopaths currently practicing in 1980. More than half of these were graduates of NCNM since its first class graduated in 1961. This meant that of the approximately 4,000 to 6,000 or more licensed naturopathic physicians who had made up this profession between roughly 1910 when we were first licensed in 1980, most were no longer in practice. The profession had declined substantially, so much so, in fact, that medical historians in the 1970s and 1980s wrote of this profession as a dead branch on the tree of the healing arts. We were considered a dead branch when I matriculated at NCNM in 1975, and we were considered a dead profession at the time I graduated and began my practice. I did not know that. Had I known that, perhaps I might have made a different professional decision. When I started school, we were licensable in 8 states. When I graduated, the number had declined to 6. So my graduation, in some respects, marked the lowest point to which the profession had fallen. Yeah, that's kind of a joke. Look around. How many doctors are sitting here? Our numbers now exceed 5,000 in the U.S. and Canada. Our biggest problem, in my opinion, is that there are not enough of us. But in 30 years, we have gone from 1 school to 7, and soon there will be more. We have increased in licensing jurisdictions, 14 now in the U.S. We are increasing in practice privilege. When I began, I could not do IV therapeutics except in certain emergency situations. I could not inject medicines. Thanks to Dr. Ralph Weiss and Don Walker, I now hold a DEA certification, and I can prescribe any medication I might want to and administer them by any route I deem appropriate. This is a big change. I'm not so sure that this is progress, but it certainly is an expansion. We are now, thanks to Dr. William Kepler, categorized officially along with MDs and DOs in terms of our degree status. We are increasing in recognition and privilege both politically and among the larger medical community. For the first time this year, I could list myself as a physician on my Washington acupuncture license renewal. Previously, I had to list an MD or DO to whom I could refer if necessary. someone to give me diagnostic information. For the first time, I fit that category. It is gratifying to see this. This is not like it was 31 years ago. From where do we come? Why do we exist as a separate profession? And should we? I have read arguments recently by some of my colleagues that we should not be considered primary care physicians. I rail against this, but the question has been posed. Some would argue that we are not primary care physicians. Do we have a standard of care, a standard of practice, and is this different from other physicians, the MD or the DO? I can diagnose and treat human illness under my own authority. I can legally sign birth and death certificates, at least in Oregon. Therefore, I am a primary care physician, something we have fought for over 100 years to attain and maintain. We are a separate and distinct branch of the healing arts with our own standards. I am not held to the standards of other professions, and I don't intend to be. This is my profession, sitting in this room. We decide what is appropriate for us. Why did I begin my talk as I did, with reference to God? Did I do that just to irritate Eric Yarnell? Partly. He and I have a thing, you might say, not that kind of thing. We are different. We disagree about some important things. And yet we respect each other, both as physicians and as thinkers in this profession. I consider him a friend and a colleague. I like him. He's just wrong about a lot of things. But I began, as I did, for several other reasons to which I will refer over the next 90 minutes or so. Who are we? What is a naturopathic physician? How is it that one cannot predict what to expect upon entering a naturopathic physician's office for the first time? Joe Holcomb coined an interesting phrase, naturopathic physicians all the same, only different. I wonder when I'm asked for a referral to a naturopath in a place where I don't know anyone, what they will encounter. I grab my AANP guidebook and look at the names and see if I know anyone, and if I don't, I give them all the names, except in a place where there's too many names. All I really know is that they have a pretty good basic medical education. They were exposed to a general set of therapeutics, and I have no idea how that will be applied. They might be a classical homeopath like Judith Reichenberg-Ullman or Stephen King, Cheryl Kipnis or Michael Traub, or a brilliant research-oriented doc like Leanna Standish or Lise Alschuler, Tim Burtzel, Lynn Patrick, Michael Uzik, or David Lamson. A scholar and second-generation naturopath steeped in the traditions and effective practices of the founders of this profession, like Letitia Dick Cronenberg. They might be a crazy genius on the cutting edge, like Greg Nye, or a solid, intelligent, basic naturopath, the kind you can trust your patients to, like Jacob Shore, Rena Bloom, Mona Morstein, Tim Murbach, Tad Jacobs, Brett Jakes, Mark Stengler. Well, there's really nobody like Jacob Shore. Some will diagnose through applied kinesiology or with some bioelectronic computer or a basic history and physical exam or a plethora of laboratory tests. I have no idea. I pretty much know what will happen if my patient goes into the office of a medical doctor anywhere in the United States. I pretty much don't know what will happen in a naturopath's office. All the same, only different. So what is a naturopathic physician? Let me ask a more basic question. What is a physician? I have heard arguments recently that we are not really physicians. There are places like California where I'm not allowed to call myself a physician. Lise Alschuler corrected me the other day in misstating that in Washington we are allowed to call ourselves physicians through an odd twist, even though it says on my license, naturopathic physician, I'm not legally allowed to call myself that. I'm a naturopathic doctor in Washington and a naturopathic physician in Oregon. What is a physician? The word physician is a derivative of the Greek word physis, which translates as nature. The same word which is the root of the word physics. The physician is the natural scientist, the one who studies nature. It has come to mean the licensed medical practitioner, a person educated at the university level in the medical arts and sciences, not the surgeon. You may have seen, particularly on older doctors' shingles, John Smith, MD, physician and surgeon. The physician is one who applies the medical arts to ease human suffering and disease, one who studies and applies nature to ease suffering, usually giving medicines for this purpose. A surgeon is one who cuts for healing. Historically, these two were separate. By any but the most parochial definition, a naturopath is a physician. The naturopathic physician of today, in my opinion, is the truest physician in our culture. The truest example of the historical physician's art, trained in the depth of the biomedical sciences, a student of nature and the natural approaches to healing. Some of us actually go into the wilds of nature to obtain our medicines. I know of no MDs who do that. One does not find Prozac or Mevacor or Atenolol growing in the forests. One of my great joys is an annual trek to the slopes of the Eastern Cascades where I harvest some wild chelush. Chelush is the term used by the local native Columbia River people for what we call lomatium, one of the finest antivirals that exists. Louise Billy, the matriarch of the river people, took my wife to this spot several years ago and taught her how to gather the chelush. There's a special tool they use, developed for this purpose, that they call a cuppin. It looks kind of like a T bent on the bottom, made out of iron. A root-digging tool. Grandma Louise gave one to my wife and taught her to use it. But you should have seen Louise dig up the roots. I guess she could get six or seven in the same time my wife Lauren could get one, and she was in her 80s. And she led the trek up the hill. This was one of John Bastier's favorite local medicines that he also gathered from the wild. Two good-sized roots will make enough medicine for a year in my practice, about a gallon of tincture. It is very powerful, and one only needs a little bit of it. One drop on the tongue will take out most sore throats. I keep a little bottle of it, a dropper bottle, on my desk, and when someone complains of a sore throat, I just say, open your mouth and put a drop on their tongue. And most of the time, that takes care of that. We have the great privilege of being physicians, practitioners of the art and science of easing human suffering. We get to spend time with our patients. We get to know them. We get to discover who they are and why they are ill. We get to help remove the causes of their illness and then apply our skills and knowledge to help restore their health and ease their suffering. Yes, I know that in California I'm not allowed to call myself a physician, at least not yet. I may refer to myself as a doctor. This is the prejudice of the current age. And that is changing. I still run into it. Recently, at a local hospital, I had sent a patient. She was there for a few days. I went in. I introduced myself to the charge nurse as Dr. Zeff. I was listed in the patient's chart as the PCP. I asked to see the chart, which I had done several times before with other patients in the same hospital. In one case, I had participated in the tumor board for a patient of mine there. The nurse required my credentials, and I handed her my pocket copy of my license. She refused to allow me to see the chart and pointedly called me Mr. Zeff after reading my license and admonished me not to give any medicine to the patient. This is the same hospital that had invited me to give a grand rounds the year before. Yes, we are still subjected to prejudice and ignorance. The fact that this surprised me showed me how far we had come. The fact that this happened showed me how far we have to go. 30 years ago, when I opened my practice in McMinnville, my new practice with my partner, Bruce Dixon, I approached the local obstetrician and asked him about referring patients to him, if necessary. He responded that I should be in jail for what I did, that is, natural childbirth. So things have changed. The physician is the natural scientist, the student of nature, of health and illness, and the one who applies this knowledge to help the ill and the infirm. What is a naturopathic physician, and how are we different from any other physician? The primary thing, in my opinion, is that we approach healing from a deep respect for the vis medicatrix naturae, for the natural process of healing, and the natural wisdom of the body. This is a real difference, or at least it can be. As Holly Lucille said in a talk a couple years ago, quoting a brilliant young doctor, the body will heal when the conditions for healing have been established. My grandson recently scraped his toe riding his little bicycle without shoes on. He scraped the tip and scraped off a bit of the nail. Through his tears, he asked for some calendula, and then we watched the toe heal over the next few days. My grandson's toe healed because this is how he was made. His toe healed not because of the calendula, but because of the vis medicatrix naturae. It knew how to heal. The knowledge of how to heal was built into the structure and substance of the cells of the toe. We refer to this internal inherent knowledge as the vis medicatrix naturae. As physicians, we do not need to make this happen. We rely upon it happening. The phrase vis medicatrix naturae is attributed to Hippocrates, though in a recent search I did for our textbook, I could not find such a statement in any of Hippocrates. I think it was Paracelsus who attributed this to Hippocrates. Paracelsus also told us that the first physician is nature. When we, the AANP, defined our profession in 1989, we did so through a set of principles, a set of primary concepts. Previously, we had been defined by modalities. We were physicians who used certain medicines and techniques, but not others. That definition was not only limiting, it was contentious and inaccurate. Our prerogatives varied state by state, and there was a constant fight about what we could do or could not do or could use or could not use. The AANP created this definition project back in 1986. We could not agree on what modalities defined us. But we could all agree on one thing, on the fact that we shared a common philosophy. So we set out to discover what that philosophy was and to articulate it. In 1989, 3 years later, we all agreed, all of us then in the AANP, even Randall Bradley, that there were principles to which we all agreed, and that the first of these was vis medicatrix naturae. From this principle flow the others. I want to clear up a common misperception that I see, unfortunately, repeated often in our profession. Our first principle is not, first, do no harm. I know it kind of seems like it should be. After all, it says first. But let me retranslate primum non nocere. Of primary importance is to do no harm, or above all, do nothing to harm the patient further, or simply, do no harm. Primum non nocere comes from vis medicatrix naturae. It literally comes out of it. This medicatrix is the primary principle, the first principle, the sine qua non, the without which not, of naturopathic medicine. To really understand primum non nocere, you need to understand this medicatrix first. I used all this Latin especially for Tim Birdsall. I don't know if you follow NatChat, but we've had a recent discussion concerning our elections about our language. I like the Latin. If you would like a deeper explanation of these things I've just been talking about. You can read about it in our upcoming Foundations of Naturopathic Medicine textbook if that monster ever sees the printing press. Okay, Pam, I'm sorry. The book is scheduled to go to the printer in about a year. We're in the editorial process at the moment. This Medicatrix Naturae is, in my opinion, the deep central taproot of naturopathic medicine. What do we mean by this Medicatrix Naturae, the healing power of nature? Here is how we, as a profession, defined this phrase back in 1989. The healing power of nature, vis medicatrix naturae. The healing power of nature is the inherent self-organizing and healing process of living systems which establishes, maintains, and restores health. Naturopathic medicine recognizes this healing process to be ordered and intelligent. It is the naturopathic physician's role to support, facilitate, and augment this process by identifying and removing obstacles to health and recovery, and by supporting the creation of a healthy internal and external environment. In a recent ND chat exchange, Tad Jacobs wrote the following. When we say the healing power of nature, we are saying nature is already whole. We are saying we work with our current understanding of how nature, both in our bodies and throughout our surroundings, operates. It may sound unsophisticated superficially, but sometimes the simplest assertions are deeply, deeply profound. As I see it, it is because that we strive to understand and work with nature that we, by the very root meaning of the title, are the true physicians. Wow, thank you, Tad. The concept of vis medicatrix naturae is simple and yet complex. It is a point of controversy for us. What does it mean? As naturopaths, we represent more or less the vitalist thread of medical thought in the West. Though vitalism is a point of contention in science, one can define the vis in a materialist or mechanistic manner. Our own Eric Yarnell has a brilliant materialist explanation in the vis medicatrix naturae in our upcoming Foundations textbook, which contrasts to other more vitalist explanations. Is there a mystical force we call the vis, the force of Star Wars? Is it simply the inherent property of matter as it has accidentally developed into living organisms? Is it definable or in any way something that can be studied or measured by Liana or Carlo Calabrese or Michael Uzik? I learned several ways to evaluate vitality in my patients, to measure their vitality. But is this the same as the vis? Is the vis vitality? I want to address this because I think it is of key importance to understand vis medicatrix naturae. And again, this is one of the reasons why I began my talk the way I did. We said in our definitive statement on the vis that the healing power of nature is the inherent self-organizing and healing process of living systems which establishes and maintains and restores health. Naturopathic medicine recognizes this healing process to be ordered and intelligent. Inherent, self-organizing, process, living systems, ordered and intelligent. But where did it originate? From whence comes the order? By what principle can something be self-organizing? The brilliant Greg Nye wrote in a recent exchange on Mona Morstein's NatChat, for which, by the way, she should certainly be named Physician of the Year at some point. Or along with her Lifetime Achievement Award for leading us in understanding how to work with diabetes and insulin. Greg wrote, A whole field of scientists have explored this very issue exhaustively and find that there is no known mechanism within science which can explain the origins of biological information, nor the directed evolutionary pathways those systems have moved along. There is no branch of chaos theory or emergence theory or, for that matter, evolutionary biology or genetics or any other that has put forth a scientific explanation for the origins of biological information. The amount of information contained in the DNA of the simplest known living organism is astronomical. About 450 genes are needed. One mathematician calculated the probability of a string of DNA that size coming together by chance by randomly shuffling nucleotides. The probability is 10 to the minus 40,000, a number so close to zero that there's no meaningful difference between the two. As a reference point, the probability of generating a single biologically useful and very small protein of 150 amino acids by randomly combining those amino acids is about a trillion times less likely than the probability of selecting a single marked atom out of all the atoms in our galaxy through a random selection of an atom, unquote, Greg Nye. Think about this statement. The likelihood of life originating by random chance is less than the likelihood of randomly selecting a predetermined atom from all the atoms in our galaxy. The likelihood of doing this in the time that the universe has existed, say about 13.75 billion years or so, is an impossibility. This is why the atheist scientists of the 1950s argued against the Big Bang theory, the theory that says the universe begins with an explosion of light. For life to randomly generate requires a universe of infinite existence. It just couldn't have happened in so short a time as 13 billion years or so that the Big Bang theory allows. To quote from Greg Nye again, "Before any discussion of evolution can even begin, there needs to be an explanation of how such an enormous amount of information came about prior to any ability to self-replicate, that is, to be susceptible to the push and pull of selection pressures, and prior to the existence of complexity as it applies to biologically relevant molecules. No one has proposed such an explanation, even though there was $1 million reward for the first viable hypothesis," unquote. Anthony Flew, once considered the world's most notorious atheist, is a brilliant philosopher. And for decades, he wrote books explaining the rightness of atheism. Then he changed his mind. In his book On the Switch, he states that he always considered it important to go wherever the evidence leads. The evidence led him to change his mind. Frank Tipler, PhD, wrote in The Physics of Immortality similarly, "When I began my career as a cosmologist some 20 years ago, I never in my wildest dreams imagined that one day I would be writing a book purporting to show through straightforward deductions of the laws of physics that there is a non-physical cosmic force guiding evolution." Back to Greg. "I'm not arguing for any particular theistic explanation of things. I'm suggesting that there are only a few possible explanations for the presence of information and intelligence. Either it's the product of undirected processes, or it's the product of directed processes. No one is proposing that there is, within coherence theory, a purposeful, goal-directed force operating as a result of random and complex interaction. In other words, it is a theory for complex organization, but not for the appearance of information, because the information had to precede the complexity. No one has ever proposed that complex interactions of undirected parts can produce intelligence by this definition. When we say that nature and the healing processes of the body have intelligence, if we're using a standard definition of that word, then we're saying that they are the product of a mind, that they operate by a plan that is an abstraction from the events that carry out that plan. To say that something is intelligent in and of itself has no reference to any process found in nature except those associated with the mind, unquote. Wow. I hope you got all that. In other words, the latest of modern science leads to an awesome conclusion. The best we can currently say is that a mind existed prior to the development of life and prior to the development of the information that underlies the universe. Everything we know that has a beginning has a cause. We know of nothing that has come into existence without a cause. If every effect in nature has a cause, then what is the cause of nature? Most particularly, the information that orders the universe, the laws of physics, and the laws that govern life. Eric may be right, but I do not think so. Bill Mitchell discussed this question in one of his talks at the AANP several years ago. He explained how the energy in that moment of creation was so exact that if it had been 1/16 trillionth greater, the explosion would have been too fast for atoms to condense. Or 1/16 trillionth less, 16 trillionth less, and the universe would have collapsed back upon itself in about 5,000 years or so. He went on to discuss how in that moment of creation, that moment of the perfect amount of energy and substance to allow for the development of the universe and its continued existence, all that ever would be was laid out in some form of promise and began to unfold. You are, at this point in time and space, the culmination of the Big Bang and all that it contained manifested at this moment where you are sitting. Everything that ever would be began at that moment. The laws of physics and the vis medicatrix naturae were there, as were each of you in some nascent form. The fact that you are here is proof that you were present in some aspect in that initial moment of creation, awaiting your moment to unfold. Truly amazing and awesome. Let me return to the Big Bang for a moment, that explosion of light plasma in which the universe was created. Let me quote from an older book. "In the beginning, the earth was without form, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and God said, 'Let there be light,' and there was light, and it was good." How did they know back about 3,500 years ago when that was written that the universe began in a burst of light? Okay, I apologize to Eric. But what does this have to do with naturopathic medicine or the vis medicatrix? I've been flashing some of my colleagues' statements and thoughts regarding the vis medicatrix up on the screen. At the end of his life, Bill Mitchell was proposing a new understanding of vis medicatrix naturae. He was developing the idea of the vis as an equation. Part of the reason that I'm using these slides with his picture is because I miss him. I miss him being here. I miss him talking to us and the magic that happened when he did. The implications are startling, but made even more complex by the fact that the equations are evolving. The Big Bang has a point in time at which it occurred. Before it occurred was its cause. The cause has several characteristics, one of which was its perfection in terms of the energy involved, the fact that it contained precisely the right amount of energy. Another was its perfection in terms of the organization involved. It contained the laws of physics. This perfection of information that occurred prior to the Big Bang, that initiated the Big Bang, and that was contained within the Big Bang can best be described in terms of what we call a mind a priori the existence of the universe. The best we know at this time from cutting-edge physics is that the inherent knowledge within us, that information that healed my grandson's toe, what I call the vis, the cellular knowledge of healing and biological organization, was infused into the structure of the universe at the moment of that initial explosion of light. The information that led to the creation of DNA. This is the knowledge that takes the tiny zygote and grows it so that the eyes form at the right time and in the correct place, and the fingers and the toes and all the rest. I want to thank Pam Snyder and Joe Pizzorno and the Foundations Project for these slides on the vis. This is the same information that constantly strives to optimize the function of the organism, given the conditions within which the organism exists. This is the internal healer and organizer. This is the vis. Eric Yarnell astutely points out that this same universe produced errors, birth defects, anthrax, and Mao Zedong, to whom I was recently likened. And therefore, this wise or intelligent universe is not necessarily a benign place. It can kill you. It absolutely will kill each of us eventually, at least in our current physical form. Patrick Donovan has written some amazing work on death. He has addressed this topic here before, and I hope to see him do so again in a future discussion here, the vis and death. I will avoid this for the moment. Yes, anthrax and smallpox and birth defects and cancer and war and deformed babies all are contained in the information and substance and process of our universe. So is healing and medicine and chelush and surgeons and naturopathic physicians, those to whom Bill Mitchell once referred as the lymphocytes of Gaia. So vis medicatrix naturae, the healing power of nature, is a set of information built into the living organism that helps direct its maintenance and function. It originates with the inception of the universe. It is the product of the mind that preceded and created the universe along with the laws of physics. It can be described in material terms, in materialist terms. But its origin precedes the material, at least so it seems from the evidence I have encountered. It is the inherent self-organizing and healing process of living systems which establishes, maintains, and restores health. So what? What is the significance of this to the clinician? How might this affect what the physician does or does not do in the clinic? What difference does it make? To address this, I want to digress for a bit and talk about how I came to develop the ideas that have gotten me into so much difficulty, these concepts I have discussed before of the healing, of healing as a process and of a therapeutic hierarchy. It all began by accident, as these things go. On my way to medical school, I got sidetracked and ended up at National College, a tiny, funky pretense of a medical school on the third floor of the old postal building in Skid Row in Portland before it was renovated, across the street from the Moeller Barber College, amidst the pawn shops and the Bon Ton Cafe. This was before most of you were around. We were up there with a tailor and a goldsmith. But we expanded. We took over the fourth floor and created our clinic. Then a larger campus and expanded ultimately into what is now seven schools. I graduated from there in 1979 and began a practice with Bruce Dixon in McMinnville. And in that same year, I was asked to teach. I apologize for that. It is so inappropriate for recent graduates to teach in our schools. They have nothing to teach yet. But in those days, it was the best we could do. There's no excuse for it now, of course, but then there were so few of us and so few doctors with any experience. The best count we could make in 1980 was that there were about 200 practicing naturopaths in all of North America. But when I graduated, I went to the dean, Jim Sensenig, who had graduated the year before I did. And asked how I could help with the school. He said, "You wrote a good paper in gastro." He was my gastro instructor. "Would you like to teach gastro next year?" I agreed. But I grew in the teaching. I vowed always to teach a better course than I had received. That first year, 1979, I taught gastroenterology and medical history. The second year, I was asked to teach naturopathic philosophy, which began my love affair with that subject. I maintained a full-time practice and taught a few courses at the college each term, including philosophy. But 2 years out of school, I began to get discouraged. I could do pretty well with acute maladies, but I had no real confidence or knowledge about how to effectively treat really sick people, people with chronic disease. So I decided to enter the University of Oregon Medical School. I wanted to become a better naturopath, but I thought if I could do IV vitamins, this was not within our scope of practice then, if I could do IV vitamins, maybe that would work better. I would have greater exposure to pathology. I would learn more. I could do my own C-sections. My primary interest at that time was OB. I was unsatisfied with my OB training at NCNM and wanted more, and was able to create a small residency in OB with an MD in Southern California, Dr. Hai Abdul. We delivered about a baby every 10 hours. During that time, I spent down there with him, and I learned how to deal with obstetrical emergencies, which was my goal. But at med school, how much more could I learn? Anyway, I was happy with my OB practice, but as an MD-ND, I could do more, and I began the enrollment process. I had to take the MCATs, of course, but that was pretty easy, having already gone through medical school once. I took the MCAT review course, then took the test, and did well on it. During that summer, I was preparing for my entrance into OHSU, but I was just not sure. I took several days out and fasted, no food, no water, and prayed and asked God for help and guidance with that decision. Was this the right way to go? Now, at that time, I was also vice president of the OANP. Again, there were not many of us, and we all wore many hats. I was in charge of CE under President Noel Peterson, who had graduated a year before me. I liked to find older doctors who would come and talk with us about their experience and teach us. In that capacity, I heard of an old naturopath, Dr. Harold Dick, and convinced him to speak at an OANP CE seminar. He was reluctant, telling me that I've been trying to talk to this profession for 30 years, and you have no interest in hearing anything I have to say. But I persisted and managed to convince him to come. I told him, "I've never heard you talk." So he agreed. He came and talked to us about what he did, about how to heal really ill patients. What he told us was that the difficult cases were really easy. It was the impossible cases that were challenging. And he told us how he did it. I thought either he was full of it, or he knew something really important that I didn't. So the next time I had an impossible case, I took that patient up to Spokane to Dr. Dick and spent the day in his clinic. And I was amazed at what I saw. It was quite different from what I had seen at NCNM, where we were mostly teaching ourselves, where most of my teachers were a year or so ahead of me. Fortunately, we don't need to do that anymore, as there are now about 5,000 of us, many with at least 10 years clinical experience. I realized that I had found in Dr. Dick what I was looking for. I discarded my application to OHSU and continued to study with Dr. Dick. I went up to his clinic in Spokane for a few days each month, trying to learn how he got such amazing results with difficult cases. He told me he was simply doing the constitutional hydrotherapy of O.G. Carroll. So I learned how he did it, and I did it in my office just the way I saw him doing it, and I did not get the results he was getting. My patients were not getting amazing improvement. Had I made a mistake? Should I have continued into OHSU? Finally, I realized that he was giving each patient a diet based upon some old allergy test. He called it an allergy test, anyway. So he told each patient to quit eating his allergy as identified by this test. Then he gave them hydrotherapy. He also worked with homeopathy and botanical medicine and glandular supplements and a few other things. The man I took up there with the incurable terminal kidney disease got better, to the amazement of his doctors at USC Medical School. They told him they did not understand how he could be better, but whatever he was doing, he had better continue because he was improving. He continued to improve as long as he followed Dr. Dick's advice. He amazed his docs at USC, though they never did inquire into why he was improving. What I learned, though, was that the key was dietary. After I realized that this diet thing was the key to improvement, I began having Dr. Dick run his allergy tests for my patients, and I gave them the recommended dietary changes, and then I started to see the improvement that I had come to expect from the hydrotherapy I saw in his clinic. The first such case was one of a recalcitrant dermatitis. A woman in her 40s came to see if I could help with her dermatitis. Cortisone creams had not helped. She had also retinitis pigmentosa, but we both knew that was incurable and irreversible. But I gave her the diet based on Dr. Dick's allergy test and began hydrotherapy with her, and her skin began to improve. And so did her blindness. Much to her and my amazement, I saw the blindness reverse. And her vision returned, not totally, but she went from being unable to see anything but vague gray shapes to being able to read large print books in several weeks. I learned to treat strep with hydrotherapy. I learned how to treat COPD with hydrotherapy. I learned to treat arthritis with hydrotherapy, and my practice fundamentally changed. Once I began to integrate all this in my own mind, I was compelled to change how I was teaching naturopathic philosophy. I finally understood that one of the fundamental roots of naturopathic medicine, something I had heard about in school, but that was not emphasized either in my education or my clinical training, I finally understood the toxemic basis of disease. Toxemia is one of the roots of naturopathic medicine. This concept did not originate with Dr. Dick or Dr. Carroll. It did not originate with Dr. Lust. Lust got it from Kuna. But it did not originate with Kuna. Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote that the Egyptians purged themselves with aloes 3 days each month, realizing that the seat of illness was putrefaction in the colon. The concept of toxemia is ancient. So what is toxemia? Is it real? Lust wrote, "It was Kuna's genius that conceived the theory of the unity of disease." Kuna, in The New Science of Healing, wrote, "Disease is the process of foreign matter in the system, is the presence of foreign matter in the system." He states that there is only one cause of disease, and there is also only one disease, which shows itself under different forms. Kuna describes how disease originates with the accumulation of toxins in the body, primarily through disturbed digestion. And treatment needs to be based upon stopping the intoxication and then stimulating the emunctories, the organs and roots of toxic elimination from the body. The concept of toxemia is part of the basic body of knowledge of the naturopathic physician. At least it used to be. Let me begin with a definition of toxemia. Maldigestive processes fostering a dysbiotic intestinal population, which generate toxic products through inappropriate degradation of poorly digested foods. These toxins enter the blood and become the basis for chronic inflammatory processes, autoimmune processes, etc. This intoxication promotes infection. For those who require it, there exists a history of scientific validation of the concept. Let me cite a few sources. As early as 1879, Bauman demonstrated that tyrosine is metabolized by gut bacteria to generate phenol and p-cresol. Phenols and p-cresol are implicated in tumor formation in mice. Certain phenols are demonstrated as convulsant agents in humans. In 1924, Harkey and Kessler demonstrated the generation of histamine by gut bacterial action on dietary amino acids. Perry demonstrated the generation of the body burden of tyramine is entirely by gut flora. Both histamine and tyramine are implicated in hypertension, suggesting that essential hypertension may be the result of toxemia. In 1974, Dracer and Hill published Human Intestinal Flora. Human Intestinal Flora is not a naturopathic book, although I have found it one of the most valuable in my library. It's a microbiology text demonstrating multiple pathways of bacterial degradation of dietary elements and bile residues into toxic metabolites absorbed into the bloodstream. They demonstrate significant implications for carcinogenesis and the origins of chronic inflammatory disease. In my opinion, this is one of the most definitive and significant roots of our medicine, the concept of the toxemic basis of disease. I do not believe that Kuhne was correct, that toxemia is the universal or unifying cause of disease. In my experience, this is a very significant cause of most disease, a primary or contributing cause of much disease. I have found that I can improve my success by beginning most patients with work designed to reduce toxemia, most especially dietary changes, followed by constitutional hydrotherapy and a good simple stomach tonic. I have found increasing validation of this concept in the increasing understanding of the inflammatory basis of much chronic disease in the standard medical literature. Toxemia is a primary cause of underlying inflammation. These toxins generate inflammatory response in the tissues affected. Note Carlo, Michael, Lynn, this can be tested. A task for those of us compelled to such research. It is toxemia that Dr. Dick was going after with his dietary changes, not allergic reactions. Though he referred to the offending foods as allergies, in reality, he was discerning foods that did not digest well. That which does not digest well putrefies and ferments in the digestive tract, giving rise to toxic metabolites, hence toxemia. In reality, as we would define it today, he was discerning food intolerances, foods that for genetic, enzymatic reasons cannot digest or metabolize well in a particular body, giving rise to toxemia. The dietary reactions demonstrated by O.G. Carroll's old method are a fundamental cause of illness. As I grew to understand this simple concept and learned to apply it in practice, I saw amazing things. I've reported on some of these in different courses and talks, and some of you have heard this before. 3 years ago, I reported on reversing a case of MRSA osteomyelitis that was scheduled to have a woman's leg amputated. She is walking today on both of her natural legs because of the application of this simple concept. I am not a wonder worker. I'm not a little god of healing. I am simply a naturopathic physician, practicing more or less in the original ways of this profession. Not all my patients get well, but most do. In trying to articulate this to my first-year naturopathic philosophy students, I developed an explanation of disease as a process, as opposed to the biomedical model of disease as pathologic entities. This explanation is another way of stating what Kuhne called the unity of disease theory. This is a root of naturopathic medicine. This was a question on my initial Oregon board exam back in 1979. Our exam then in those days were mostly essay questions graded by older doctors. We were asked to explain the concept of the unity of disease. Lust and Lindlar wrote about it. Kuhne wrote about it. This is an articulation of this root concept. I called this model the process of healing. It is what I observed Dr. Dick doing. The concept did not originate with me. You can find it explained a bit differently in Lindlar's Nature Cure, first published in 1913. You can find it in Kuhne. You can find it in various forms in the medical literature going back to Hippocrates. If we look at healing as a process, we can see this healing process operating in illness of all types. If the process is governed by an intelligence that precedes the material but is infused within the structure of the material, we can look for that intelligence to present itself in the healing process. It's fairly simple and can be reduced at least to this simple model in my mind anyway. Normal function is disturbed. Disturbance disrupts normal function. The organism reacts to the disturbance with processes to throw off the disturbance and to restore normal function, like fever and inflammation. The products of these processes are discharged from the system along with the products of the disturbance. The system returns to normalcy. Chronic disease originates when the disturbing factors continue to enter the system. This is the real key. What's disturbing the system? Or when the reactive state is either suppressed, often by drugs, or when the system does not have the vitality to mount a reactive state. So it can't respond and throw off the effects of the disturbance. These arrows show us the direction that we can work with. When we find somebody in a degenerated state, the key from this perspective is to look here. What is disturbing function? Reduce this. Then use methods to stimulate the self-healing mechanisms, the vis medicatrix, that then will move the patient back up in this direction, often into an acute reactive state, which we call a healing crisis, or healing reaction, which will be followed by a discharge of some kind and then a return to normalcy. This is old-fashioned naturopathic theory. Working with disease as process within this model, to me, is key to understanding what I do. We are taught in the standard medical model to focus upon pathology. Even in naturopathic medicine, there is a great emphasis upon the diagnosis of disease using the pathologic model and to treat disease often with evidence-based natural medicines. Does this adequately characterize naturopathic medicine or even accurately categorize us? It is comfortable to rest there. It integrates us into the standard medical model with little difficulty, just arguments over the nature of evidence. In that model, we are doing essentially the same thing as the standard medical doctor, treating pathology only with different medicines. But I think this is too limiting and certainly does not characterize the medicine as it has existed historically. It does not characterize the way that Dr. Dick was successfully treating people for whom that model had failed. What I saw from him and then later reflected in a host of literature that characterized the early days of this profession and its predecessors was an entirely different paradigm. In this other model, pathology hardly makes a difference. It certainly does not direct treatment, at least not for the most part. So I use this little graphic to explain this process. And I apologize to those of you who have seen this too many times before in my classes. In this model, the key is the original disturbance, not the pathology. Pathology is the expression of disturbance in the body. Treatment is more or less the same, regardless of pathology, because it is the process of the illness that we are affecting, not the specific manifestations. Most disease can be fit into this model. Acute pharyngitis fits, cancer fits. This model instructs us to identify disturbing factors, reduce them, and then stimulate the vis medicatrix naturae, the healing mechanisms, and then expect the internal wisdom, the vis, to carry the patient to improvement. One can treat the pathology and follow this model as long as the treatment of the pathology does not suppress the healing process, the reactions that the body is mounting to throw off the disturbance. And even then, there's great forgiveness in the system. I have seen these methods work through much suppressive treatment successfully, but they will not always work through that. This is why it is important to understand the philosophy and to be able to recognize the signs of healing. These signs can be characterized by what we have come to call Herring's laws, but are not limited to them. It is important to be educated in and to understand the nature of pathology and to know the process of healing. Pathology is part of the common body of knowledge that defines us as physicians, regardless of which branch of medicine we ascribe to. We know the difference between a sebaceous cyst and a squamous cell carcinoma. The difference is critical. We know that the abdominal pain could be merely gas pressure, or it could be due to an acute appendicitis. As physicians, we need to know about these things and how to discern them. We share this knowledge with other physicians, the basic medical sciences. What makes us different, at least I would propose what makes us unique, is our philosophy. That philosophy is based upon an understanding of and a trusting in the healing processes that are inherent to the organism. It includes an understanding of the laws of healing, which as naturopaths we also need to know. The greatest key to the healing that I have encountered in my 31 years in practice, though, is this root concept of toxemia and the unitary basis of disease, the process of healing. In December, a woman came to see me who was terrified. She was told she needed immediate surgery to open her cardiac blood vessels. She was terrified that she would die on the surgical table. She asked if I could help her. First, I tried to discern the basis of her fears. I explained how these surgeries were commonplace, that people rarely died from them, but she was adamant she would not consider surgery. Could I help her? Would I help her? I told her we would take it a day at a time. If she improved and continued to improve, then we would keep at it. If she did not, then she would have the surgery. So we began. I used old Doc Carroll's allergy test and told her to quit eating potato. We began daily hydrotherapy. We used a simple digestive tonic and a simple cardiotonic. I gave her a dose of Cactus 200C in my office, and her chest pain, which had been nearly constant, even with nitro, abated. I sent her home with Cactus 6C QID, a cardiotonic, digestive tonic, and a vial of the Cactus 200 to use along with or in place of the nitro when she needed it. I saw her each day for a month for the hydrotherapy. She got better and better. Her pain became less intense and more intermittent. After a month, we stopped the hydrotherapy. She continued with the rest of the regimen. Her symptoms continued to improve. 4 months later, she had another angiogram. Her cardiologist was astonished. Of the 5 blockages, 4 were not there, and the 5th, the worst, was substantially reduced. The cardiologist said it was a miracle. She no longer needed the surgery. It must have been the statins, she said, acknowledging that statins do not do this. But what else could it have been? Of course, she reiterated, statins do not do this, but it must have been the statins. Had I not done this before, or had I no confidence in these methods, I might not have attempted this. I would have been afraid. But both John McDougall, M.D., Dean Ornish, M.D., have published extensively on this, on how they could reverse arterial plaquing with dietary changes and exercise. Dr. Dick told me that I could trust the hydrotherapy. And over the years, I have found that this was true. I have treated about 10,000 patients, and I have confidence in these methods. They work for me. And this is why. I have seen these miracles before, big ones like this one and little ones. To be honest, I must report that Michael Uzik and I did an experiment several years ago which demonstrated the lack of scientific validity of this method of dietary evaluation, at least within the parameters of our little study, or at least within my capacity to adequately perform the methodology under the conditions we set up. So you may want to disregard what I have said about this in the last few minutes. On the other hand, I have about 10,000 patients who have demonstrated the clinical validity of this methodology by improving, some from incurable pathologies following the implementation of the dietary advice based upon this invalid methodology. So I would advise that you not adopt this method if your primary concern is with p-values and such. I mean no denigration of scientific validity. I read studies daily. Just ask Jacob Shore, who sends me at least one a day. I would only say that there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Or in other words, I do not understand how homeopathy works, though I can invent some good explanations. I just know that it works marvelously. And I do not understand some of the other things I do, including Carroll's test. I blame things I don't understand on quantum physics and let it go at that. We can demonstrate toxemia in various ways, like the urinary indicant or Obermeyer test, the acoustic cardiogram, and others, and we can demonstrate how it improves with the dietary changes and hydrotherapy, and how the patients experience measurable clinical improvement along with the reduction in toxemia. And if they reintroduce the offending foods, the toxemia returns and the symptoms also return. And that is also a scientific test, a kind of toxemic Cox postulates. I must also say that Carroll's test is not the only way to go after toxemia. It was done before he was born and before that methodology was developed. Hippocrates talked about it. There are many ways to do it, and many of you practice them. I use this method because it's what my teacher taught me and it works for me. But there are many ways to approach clinical dietary reactivity. I'm inspired by Mona Morstein. He uses U.S. biotech allergy testing and gets very good clinical results. Eric Yarnell claims that elimination challenge is the gold standard. He is wrong about that, but it is his way to approach the problem and he gets very good clinical results. Brett Jakes and Mark Stengler do it differently and make more money at it. Alex Vasquez does it differently and writes papers about it. Arlen Cage and Holly Lucille do it differently, and they all get good clinical results. All the same, only different. However one does it, it is essential and is, I think, the one common denominator in naturopathic medicine. That is, we all recognize the dietary basis of illness. Well, I doubt that we all agree to anything. But the vast majority of us agree that diet is substantially important. Toxemia is an ancient concept for which there is substantial scientific validity. It has direct clinical implications. It is a root of naturopathic medicine. It is the reason why Dr. Dick's patients got better with the hydrotherapy he did, and my patients did not get better when I was doing the same hydrotherapy until I began to deal with the toxemic basis of their disease through appropriate dietary changes. The concept that disease can be seen as a process as well as specific pathological states is another root of naturopathic medicine. It is something I can rely upon and work with. It is an anchor in the storm of incurable and chronic illness. This was the revelation that led me to understand that there is a hierarchy to the process of healing. Some things must precede other things if healing is to occur. The conditions for healing must precede the stimulation of the healing processes. I learned that appropriate dietary changes must precede the hydrotherapy. Stated more generally, the identification and amelioration of the disturbing factors must precede the stimulation of the healing processes, or aggravation will likely result. You can see this illustrated in my little diagram, which is in your notes, which, of course, have no reference whatsoever to my talk. If you don't reduce the disturbing factors and stimulate the self-healing mechanisms, you generate greater reaction. That's called aggravation. When we're asked to give these talks, we are told to turn in our notes about 2 or 3 months ago. I was asked to give this talk in October. I wrote my first talk with a complete PowerPoint, discarded that, wrote a second one with a complete PowerPoint, discarded that, did a third one. That's when my notes were due. I sent that one in, and I've done at least two since then. I developed an initial guide, back to my talk, that I published in the Journal of Naturopathic Medicine back in 1967. A guide to thinking. It had four elements. This has evolved through an academic process at Bastyr College, where I teach clinical theory, into a much more sophisticated model, mostly through the additions of Pam Snyder and her team. It exists in several versions because it is not a law, it is a guide, especially for the new practitioner. It is a clinical guide. It expresses the roots of the medicine. It complements the process of healing model, the unitary basis of disease paradigm. We call this the therapeutic order. It is simply a way to approach thinking about a case, especially a complex case. It is flexible. It shows how to integrate our entire system, including IV therapeutics, pharmaceutical prescribing, dietary changes, homeopathy, everything you might want or need to do. More experienced docs do not need this guide, but younger docs might find it useful. It contains several concepts. It progresses from a general toward a specific, from less toward more invasive and potentially harmful interventions. If you do not know what to do with the complex case, start here. Look for what can be disturbing the person. Look to diet and digestion, to toxemia, to psychospiritual disturbance. And then proceed down this pathway. Seek to ameliorate the disturbance or what you can access of it. Then create the circumstances for improved health. Then stimulate the vis medicatrix with hydrotherapy, homeopathy, acupuncture, exercise. Then support the various organs or systems that are stressed or damaged with botanicals, glandulars, drainage remedies, physiotherapy, and so forth. Then make sure the structure is correct, with massage and manipulation and such. If necessary, address the pathology. First, with potentially less harmful and suppressive approaches, but do what needs to be done. First, of course, you deal with pain or whatever is presenting acutely, hopefully with non-suppressive measures. Ultimately, you may need to hospitalize a patient who may need surgery or whatever. Following this hierarchy allows for and supports the action of the vis medicatrix. I treated the woman with coronary artery blockage in the same way I would treat a child with asthma. I expect the body to heal. I expect the tissues to improve themselves if the conditions for improvement can be established. This is the clinical meaning of vis medicatrix naturae. I saw a boy recently, about 8 years old. He came in with a diagnosis of asthma and allergies. He was also quite fatigued. He was on an inhaler and a couple other medications to help maintain his breathing. He would sleep until noon if you let him. This is kind of normal in a teenager, but was not in an 8-year-old. The assumption that without these medications he would continue to have breathing problems was in the air, but perhaps they were also causing the fatigue. What do you do? If you take off the medications, he can't breathe. If you give him the medications, he's not functioning right. As a naturopathic physician, my assumption is that he should be able to breathe, that there is a cause for the asthma, that the cause is a disturbing factor or factors, that we can identify them, we can remove or ameliorate them, and then we should see improved breathing. This was a simple case. I identified a milk intolerance an obvious possibility. His body temperature was somewhat low, and I thought he was also low thyroid. I advised the mom to remove milk from his diet, recommended a week of constitutional hydrotherapy to be administered at home. I gave some homeopathic antimonium tartrate and an herbal lung tonic, and I gave him an iodine pill. And Dr. Alan Christensen, thank you for that excellent article on iodine in the August NDNR. I saw this boy about a month later, pleased to hear that he had not needed his inhaler since our last visit. Yes, he was still eating cheese. The baseball team was traveling around playing its games, and there was always Friday night pizza. He was still somewhat congested, always worse on Saturday after the Friday night pizza, but he was no longer snoring, and he did not need his medication. He had more energy. He would now wake up at 10 instead of noon. So the asthma was gone in a month. With dietary change, some simple non-toxic medications, and hydrotherapy, the fatigue was improving. I talked with him about the cheese. He would have more energy without it and play better baseball. I expected the asthma to abate. It usually does. They rarely need the medications. That is to say, the inhalers. I've seen it many times. The body knows how to heal and wants to. If you create the conditions that will allow that, it usually will restore normal function. This is the vis. I identified a dietary cause of toxemic inflammation. I removed it. I stimulated the self-healing mechanisms with homeopathy and hydrotherapy, including the detoxification mechanisms, the emunctories. I used some medicine specific to the tissues and emunctories and processes involved, cactus, antimonium tartrate, heart tonics, lung tonics. I let the vis medicatrix receive this specific information. The woman with the coronary artery occlusion is not finished. She will continue to improve for probably another 6 to 9 months, and then she will likely have an acute inflammatory episode with a fever and a healing reaction. This will have to be managed appropriately. We know how, and the vis knows how. Sometimes, often, it is more complex. I saw a 5-year-old girl a while ago with a severe case of asthma. She came in on prednisone. Anytime she got a cold, she ended up in the ER with a breathing crisis, and that happened about every 6 weeks or so. She had a moon face and a round body caused by prednisone. She was on several inhalers, several other drugs, also had eczema and fecal incontinence. A more difficult case, but illustrative. Sometimes people just get better when you create healthier conditions and give a little nudge, like the boy. But she was more critical. We identified a potato intolerance, took her off potato, used homeopathic antimonium tartrate as an alternative for her inhalers, and it worked well. I gave her a botanical lung tonic, Glyceryza, Inula, Sticta, Kella. I don't use Sticta anymore because Eric Yarnell won't let me. Anyway, as we treated her, she got rapidly better. Then she developed an acute bronchitis with a fever. Here is where we really need to understand the philosophy. This pattern demonstrates a healing crisis, a healing reaction. This is a classic pattern. Change the conditions, stimulate the self-healing, see improvement, an acute crisis develops, usually with fever, and if handled correctly, complete healing results. Handling correctly means basically don't suppress the fever. Fever is not the enemy. Lindlar discussed this pattern in his section on inflammation. You can see this pattern in Hippocrates. He referred to the process as cooking the morbid substances. The body marshals its powers. The conditions of encumbrance are engaged. The body develops an acute event, usually marked by fever, which processes the disturbance. This is followed by a discharge of the remnant. The key is don't suppress the fever. Do not suppress the fever. And then you will see resolution into greater health. This is what I expect. I expect it because Dr. Dick told me to expect it. I expect it because I have seen it many times now. The girl developed an acute bronchitis with fever and lots of mucus, but no breathing crisis. This time she didn't end up in the ER. As this resolved, the asthma was gone. The skin was clear, and the incontinence was a thing of the past. No more asthma. This pattern is usually seen in some form or other if the conditions for healing are established. This process of healing is best exemplified by the common cold. Common cold is a healing process. Yes, there are viruses involved, but the pattern is clearly seen. Health is disturbed, the body becomes symptomatic. If you can identify the disturbance and remove them, stimulate the vis, one will usually see this pattern, some degree of improvement, a crisis or reactive state, a discharge and a return to normalcy. I've seen this many times. I see it regardless of the disease process, autoimmune disease, cancer, infection, etc. But things are complex in these times. The art of suppression has advanced to a great degree. Many people come to me with a number of suppressive medications. There are complications. Now, if you were not shown this in school, in a classroom, and the clinic, you would likely neither expect this nor delight in it. You would not trust it. This is one of the problems with having new graduates teach, in my opinion. What set of experiences do they have to fall back upon? Do they have the experience with these things to teach their recognition and management, or are they still in school to learn, which is why they are residents? Okay, I've said enough about that. But it is one of the weakest spots in our educational system, and it irritates me. We don't need to do that anymore. We have too many experienced docs to teach. What I have tried to do here this morning is articulate or characterize several of the significant roots of our medicine, that which is unique to us, that which defines us, at least in my opinion. This is one of the reasons for the Foundations Project. Most of you have heard of this never-ending textbook project. Okay, I'm sorry, Pam. Actually, the end is in sight. We are in the final stretches. We are assembling the manuscript now. We are in the midst of editing. Our medical editor will start to receive manuscripts in September or so. It should be on the publisher's desk about a year from now. Our profession has never done this. This project has 7 international editors representing Canada, the U.S., Europe, Australia, New Zealand. We have about 250 writers. We have writers from all of our academic institutions and most, if not all, of our ancillary institutions. We have writers from Europe, the Middle East, Canada, the U.S., of course, Central America, Australia, and New Zealand, and elsewhere. We have come together to articulate the state of the profession in the 21st century. We are organized around the fundamental principles of naturopathic medicine and their clinical application. We are attempting to articulate the root concepts of naturopathic medicine in relationship to the current sciences, as well as traditions of naturopathic medicine. In this regard, I want to acknowledge the special genius of Dr. Pamela Snyder. It is Pam's vision. She deserves that. It is Pam's vision that has formed and driven this amazing and comprehensive project. She has the genius to seek and obtain agreement among disparate elements of our little profession. Where I alienate my colleagues, she finds the common ground and expands it. This is the second time she has done this in a major project that has benefited our profession. It was her genius that organized and carried the Definition Project to a place of unanimous acceptance 21 years ago. This capacity to make the circle bigger was a great portion of the reason behind the success of that project, the Definition Project, and has been the primary importance, in my way of thinking anyway, to this current effort. Her insight in finding the common language, common strengths, common roots, and common understandings among us has kept this project on track and will lead it to completion. Thank you, Pam. So I've talked some about Vis Medicatrix Naturae. I've explained within the limits of this opportunity that the intelligence of the body precedes, in my opinion, not from the physical nature of the body, but from the very substance and intelligent creation of the universe. The information in the system is the product of downward causation. The information, the mind, came first, and the universe came afterward. To me, this is extremely significant and a substantial implication for clinical practice, but is not necessary for clinical practice. Success is not dependent upon this, only enhanced by it, at least in my opinion. I've talked some about tole causum, identify and remove the cause, which is a root concept in naturopathic medicine, and I have spoken of it in terms of toxemia. There is much more that could be said, and we could develop and teach a course in this that would fill up a semester or two if we wanted to. I could spend at least an hour acknowledging the genius and hard work of many in this room, the rootlets of our medicine, docs like Loralee Schoenbeck, who led Vermont in its recent unprecedented victories in naturopathic legislation, or Dr. Bruce Milliman. Is Loralee in here? Or Bruce Milliman of Seattle, who has helped transform not only our law in Washington, but how we are seen by the larger medical community. These people we hear little about, whose work is fundamental to the continued development of our profession. I do not know all the names of all the people. I leave that to Pam. Then there are those like Stephen Myers, MD, ND of Australia, who are working to grow our profession in other corners of the world. I look around this room with pride and awe. Pride in you, my professional family, and in our growth and development. And awe in the energy and intelligence of the people who are sitting here and have made all this happen. I want to leave you with a prophecy. I will prophesy over this house. Trust the vis medicatrix naturae. Trust the medicine. Trust its simplicity. Trust the old methods as you explore the new. They are not to be discarded. They will always work. Hydrotherapy, botanical medicine, homeopathy, and the rest. This profession will continue and will prosper. Look what has happened in 25 years. We were dead. At least they told us we were dead. Look at us now. The rate of growth in our profession is phenomenal. We are poised to impact the practice of medicine in the world. We are the blending of the brilliance of biomedical knowledge with the ancient traditions and methods of healing. Be proud of this and trust it. And thank you for the privilege of addressing you this morning.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zeff.